Today is Monday, November 23rd, 2020. This is part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Pat Gredigan, spelled G-R-E-D-I-A-G-I-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good evening, Pat. How are you today?
I'm fine. Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Pat, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do have my permission.
Thank you. We wrapped up part 3, learning about sort of your training through the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy, becoming a commissioned officer, the summers of 84 on the river, still high water, and your high water experiences of 83 and 84. And can you pick that story up again?
Yeah, sure. So the River Ranger job, the permanent job that I got into in 1983, I worked on the river for the river season, which was basically March through October. The first 2 years of that were high water. As I mentioned before, we didn't do a lot of patrols through Cataract during high water and only did about a patrol a month even when it was lower water. And so most of my time was spent either doing trip checks at the launch with rafters or doing Zodiac patrols up and down the Colorado or down the Green and up the Colorado and contacting all kinds of boaters, commercial and private, but also doing inspections on the commercial boaters. During the winters after those years, the river crew didn't have anything going on. The river shut down. People weren't on the river in any kind of numbers. I don't even know if there were. I mean, there probably were some random people. But the Park Service decided to send me out to the maze during those winter months, probably November through February is what I think, because I could work in the contact station there. I knew the maze, and I could just help out there. They really kind of needed to figure out what to do with me in the winter, and so that's what they did with me.
Okay.
So I worked out in the maze, just projects, and I can't even remember what, but mostly being in that information center, the contact center. After the, let's see, and then in 1985, I once again went back onto the river crew and did the same kind of work I'd always been doing there. But that fall, I requested that I be able to work at Joshua Tree National Monument, I think it was at the time.
Huh.
Might have been a park. The reason being that I had gone to this law enforcement training center and gotten trained, but I really had no on-the-job experience using that training. And I felt like I was losing everything that I had learned or had never really sharpened it with the with working with it. And I actually had done, a 10-day detail. They call it a detail when you leave your assigned park and go work somewhere else, but you're still paid by your park.
Okay.
And I had gone to Lake Mead, I don't know when, maybe 84, something like that, probably 84, for 10 days. I had a friend that lived there and was working there, so I stayed with his family, so it didn't cost the park anything to let me go there other than they were paying my salary. And I did road patrol with one of the employees there just to get a some experience with how that all worked.
Wow.
Because my law enforcement was just restricted to river patrols, which really nothing much was going on there, or the maze in the winter, and nothing was going on there.
At Lake Mead, road patrol, they have to deal with Las Vegas and a huge amount of tourist traffic.
Yeah. Well, wow. I just did ride-alongs with one of the rangers who had worked there for a while. So
okay.
He knew what he was doing, and I just rode along and kind of was with him and got to be part of it all and got to kind of see the bigger what a busy law enforcement situation or area was like and what doing road patrol there was like.
What did you see on those 10 days?
Oh, gosh. I don't really remember. I just remember driving around. It was hot. and I don't have specific memories of of things. I think that, you know, there probably was maybe a DUI or campground disputes or maybe speeding on the roads, those kinds of violations. It wasn't really resource violations. It was people management issues.
Or you might have seen all of those.
Yeah, I might have seen all, but I don't have any specific memories of that.
Okay.
So the next, so I still felt, though, that I was I was very under inexperienced with the law enforcement. And I suspected that my future, since I was a federal permanent law enforcement person, that eventually I probably would want to move away from Canyonlands and the river jobs, and the direction that I would go would be in some kind of law enforcement job somewhere. And I really didn't have a lot of credibility as a river ranger in law enforcement, so I asked if I could go to Joshua Tree for about 5 or 6 months. They have a busy, they have an active winter season there, and hire seasonals, and they had, I guess basically what they did, instead of hiring 3 seasonals, they hired 2 seasonals, and then they probably covered my salary for me to come work for them, although it was just a short-term thing. I hadn't officially left Canyonlands at all, so I still went back to Canyonlands in the spring after I did this detail to Joshua Tree.
How did I'm going to jump in here. How did how did you come up with this idea, and who did you ask to make it fly?
You know, I'm not sure how I came up with the idea exactly, but the chief ranger there at the time was a man named Paul Henry, and he had been the firearms instructor when I went to FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, in 1983. And so even though people go in and out of that area, I think that he did remember me. I didn't have a special relationship with him, but I was a pretty good shot, and I think he just remembered that, perhaps. So I think I got a hold of him and said, hey, remember me? I'm the river ranger from Canyonlands. And so I'm not sure how I went about it, but I think I just kind of called him and said, I'm looking for a chance to get some experience.
So Paul was the chief ranger at Joshua Tree?
Yes.
And if he was an instructor at FLETC, I would think that anyone who came to him and said, I would like to buff up my skills as an instructor, he would like be honored to be part of that.
Yeah, I think he saw what I was asking for in the bigger picture. And so he had been at FLETC in 83, and then he had gotten the chief ranger job at Joshua Tree, so he was strictly at Joshua Tree. But I told him I was trying to get some experience that I hadn't really gotten any in my park. Okay. And I think he saw that as a really valid request, and he had a position that he was going to fill anyway, and he might as well use me as use anybody. So he was, and then I talked to my boss before I ever talked to Paul and said, if I could get this to work out, would you be okay with it? And I think he said, sure, whatever. You know,
okay.
And then I called Paul, and he said, oh, yeah, we'll make it happen. So I went there, I think, probably in October of 1985 and did road patrol. The first little bit was training. The Park Service usually starts its seasons with training to where you have law enforcement refresher. We always had to have a 40-hour refresher every year. So I think I went through that there. I had gone through it in the spring in Canyonland, so I might have gone through it again at Joshua Tree. I don't remember.
Okay.
But I do know they had a 40-hour rock rescue training course that was excellent.
Oh, wow.
Where they taught a lot of basic rescue skills, not the you know, not the climbing so much, but how to go get a person who was hanging off a rock in trouble off of there. They have a lot of rock climbers use Joshua Tree, especially in the fall and the spring when it's not so hot. And so they do have, I think they had a volunteer. They did have a volunteer Joshua Tree rescue group that would be around and help with rescue. So it was a pretty active rescue program. And I got to go through their training for that. And so that was really fun. I really enjoyed that. And it was, you know, great skills to gain. So the beginning would have been some training and orientation. And then basically I just got put into the shift where I had a 8-hour shift every day to do patrols in the park, drive in a patrol car through the campground, make sure everything looked fine there, drive up and into the park, make sure nobody was driving drunk or anything like that, just making sure people were all doing what they should be doing. And so that helped me with getting used to the whole radio dispatch calling, you know, what do you say when you're stopping a car with dispatch, and how do you back people up, and just this whole car patrol, road patrol that I had never had much experience in, certainly as I did the ride along at Lake Mead, but now I was in the car and I was doing the job, and it was real good experience for me to have that. I do remember two different incidents there. One was there was a family disturbance. Basically, it was a man and a woman arguing, and I can't remember if there was physical altercation going on or not in a campground, and somebody else, I think, had called and said, we got a, you know, a domestic situation going on here in the campground. We need a ranger to come in. And so I went there, and I remember talking to him, and I remember requesting backup because it's just the thing you do if there's something that might get hinky. You want to have somebody else there with you.
Yeah.
And domestic violence or domestic situations are usually viewed as very emotional and potentially problems.
Yeah.
So I got backup, but I was just kind of trying to resolve things. And this other ranger who had worked there, he came in and he just sort of took over and said, okay, we're arresting you guys. And arrested him, and we took him to jail. And, you know, I wasn't that assertive or aggressive. I still don't know really whether arresting them was warranted, but he was not timid about it, and I was a little timid about it. It's like, well, what am I going to do now? You know, I was learning. And I remember how he just went in and did it, arrested them, took him to jail, no big deal. And I'm like, okay, well, that's how you do it. I still don't know whether they really should have been arrested or not. It seemed like maybe a step too far, but, you know, he had worked there for a while, and I was learning, and I just went along with it. So I remember that because it caused me to think things over.
Well, let's just stop right there, Pat, because I've got an interesting question. You're going to have a career in front of you in law enforcement.
Yeah.
And today there's much discussion about, I think, the lack of mental health resources in the law enforcement operations, where oftentimes a little softer touch can actually diffuse a situation.
Right. I agree with you that there's more than one way to solve this, and I always was a little bit like, I don't know if that was the best action that this other ranger took or not.
Well, so my question is, you had a chance to see that and you had a chance to question it in your future career. Did that help you kind of, did you find your own way? I guess I should like just wait, because eventually you'll get us there.
For one thing, I never did a lot of actual law enforcement. The Joshua Tree was one place, and as you'll hear in the future, there might have been another place, but I didn't have a lot of, I wasn't the person on the ground in the car very much in my whole career.
which is kind of dealing with concessions employees, bar fights, campground disturbances, speeding.
Right.
Those are the domestic disputes are the kind of the big ticket law enforcement item issues.
Right.
Poaching, of course, very deadly issues that law enforcement deals with. So if you're not working in that realm, it's not quite so problematic. But
right.
I just, I kind of wonder there wasn't another way.
Right. And my, I would say, ultimately, in summary, my approach was always to go in soft.
Okay.
And see what you could do before you started being the hard ass.
Got it.
And part of that was because I agree with the notion that a lot of times you can resolve things just by other means than arresting people. So overall, that would be my approach. The problem is that you've got to be able to shift gears. And if you just get stuck in that and things start going to where you really should separate people for their own good and take somebody away because there's a threat that they're going to be possibly threatening other people.
Right. Right.
I needed to be able to step up to that level and do it.
Yeah.
And that probably was my weak spot. That I really wasn't experienced in doing that, and I wasn't, that wasn't where I went to quickly. It never became an issue with me, as
right.
we'll talk through my career, but that was probably the point where I started thinking about, like, oh, that's one way to do it. Is there another way to do it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this is a dilemma that every commissioned officer faces.
Different officers work in different ways.
Correct.
And
yes.
It's always hard to say you're wrong and I'm right, or that's wrong and this is right.
That's right.
You know, it's a call each time.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Okay.
So the other thing I remember was that there was a Marine Corps base just outside of 29 Palms. And I lived in the town of 29 Palms. That's where the headquarters was. I would go to work there each morning, pick up a patrol car, and go up into the park. And I had some night shifts. And this wasn't a night shift, though. Maybe it was. I think it might have been in the evening. There was a young Marine on a motorcycle. I don't remember if he'd been drinking or not. It wasn't uncommon for them to be drinking and come up into the park and actually raise some hell, basically. But this guy was driving up into the park, and there was a car coming down, and I think he was towards the center line, and the car, basically, they got in a wreck. But what happened was just the left side of this guy's scraped across the left side of the car. The car was heading downhill, and he was heading uphill. So there was this motorcycle. There was a wreck. It was a motorcyclist that was in bad condition, and I went up as part of – I was a patrol officer that responded there, and the ambulance came up, and basically they were taken off. And I don't remember the people in the car, but what I remember was that this guy's arm got sheared off in the wreck.
Okay.
And so the ambulance – packaged him up and was going to haul him off, and they asked me to go look for his arm off in the bushes because they couldn't find it. So I've got my little flashlight out there, and I'm looking around for, a loose arm, and I found it. And we, they wanted it so they could possibly reattach it or something like that.
Right.
But that was kind of gory.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember it. I'm like, wow. So this is the kind of stuff I had never seen in Canyonlands, and that I felt that, if I wanted to go somewhere professionally, I needed to kind of be exposed to some of this stuff.
Right.
So those two things stand out in my mind.
Mm.
Well, I also remember one time that there was a car that was weaving a little bit in front of me, and there was this kind of idea that if they crossed the center line, this was the guy in Lake Mead, he said, if they cross that center line three times and you say, that means that they could be driving under the influence, and that's your probable cause to stop them and check them out.
Okay.
So I see this car, and it's weaving a little bit, and it weaves back, and on the third one, I'm like, oh my gosh, I think this might be a DUI. Oh my gosh, you know, I think I better stop them, and then I got to maybe arrest them. Who knows? I probably got backup called backup or something like that, because it was a big deal to me. It was like the first time. So I pull them over, I walk up to them, you know, and I start talking to them, and it's like the reason I pulled you over is because I noticed that you were weaving around, and I'm wondering if you've been drinking tonight. And it turns out that they had just been driving, hadn't slept for like 24 hours, had made a power run to get to Joshua Tree, and were really tired, and were just kind of maybe somewhat falling asleep or just not sharp. So it wasn't a DUI, as it turned out. I don't think I can't remember if I had them do any field sobriety tests or not.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere along the line, I became pretty convinced that they hadn't been drinking and that they were just tired, and their driving had looked like they were drinking because they were too tired to be driving. I don't remember what I did other than I didn't arrest them. Maybe I had them trade drivers or something like that. But
they'd have been wide awake when you pulled them over.
Well, that's true. Yeah, he might have snapped. That might have woke him up. But so I remember those three things. And I also remember being assigned to go out and watch Halley's Comet went through.
Oh, wow.
And there were people that came up from the populated areas surrounding Joshua Tree because of the clear, you know, darker skies.
Right.
And we're watching Halley's Comet like at 2 in the morning. And so I am not a night person.
Oh.
And I had to do these patrols that lasted till 2 or 2. Maybe the comet was at midnight or something, but I was up late. And I was like, I don't know if I can do this. But it was cool because I got to see the comet.
Yeah.
I was out there with the people, and there was no problems. They just wanted to have someone on patrol late in case there was a problem. But I got to see the comet, and there was a second comet that came through that year, which was really unusual. There was a follow-up comet after that came like a month later that you could see as well. So that was really cool to be able to see both of those comets. And that's what I remember mostly about Joshua Tree.
Joshua Tree would develop a reputation of kind of having a pretty rough winter climbing crowd, and their Christmas, New Year's celebrations could get a little out of hand in the campgrounds. Was that sort of just developing when you were there? Had it started up yet?
I don't remember that the troublesome part was there with celebrations. The other thing was that there were the two other seasonal rangers that were working were both climbers.
Okay.
And good with the whole rock rescue thing. And they basically were responsible for taking care of the whole climbing stuff. So I think geographically I was on the east side of the park, and they were up there where the climbers were hanging around. So I didn't end up doing much at all with the climbers, and I don't remember if I even got involved with any kind of rescues with them. I don't remember that I did.
Okay.
I might have got involved with some kind of a search for somebody that was missing. I can't remember right now. That's vaguely familiar to me. But I didn't end up doing much with the climbers.
But it would be a lot of radio work, so you'd get real comfortable with that.
Right.
You know, stops, interacting with the visitors as a law enforcement officer.
Right. Thinking through, okay, how do I protect myself and fix this problem?
Mm-hmm.
How do I protect, you know, anybody else that's around and address this problem and resolve it?
Right.
And those were just good experiences to
go through. Do you remember who the superintendent was at the time?
Don't. I have this idea of the person, but I can't come up with a name.
Kurt Sauer was going to take over that job pretty soon.
I was there in 586, and it wasn't Kurt, and maybe he took over.
Just,
you know,
after
the guy that was the superintendent, right, I think he didn't last much longer after I left, so.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then I guess Kurt went in there in the late 80s, huh?
And he retired in 90. No, and sorry, in 2000. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know.
I just didn't know history with him. I should know this.
Yeah.
Dang it.
Well, if you can remember everything you talk to people about, you're doing really well.
Well, I can't. So,
but
no, he was in there, and you know, yeah. Okay.
I don't remember that superintendent. It wasn't Kurt.
Okay.
It was his predecessor then.
Yeah. All right. And so Paul Henry was glad to have you, and that worked out well.
Right. It worked out well. I got the experience I wanted. He had a seasonal, you know, that he needed a position filled. And then at the end of what would have been the season there, and when the river season was starting back in Canyonlands, I think it was in April. It was either late March or April that I went back to Canyonlands. This was 86. And I started doing the river ranger work again. But sometime in 1986, I don't remember exactly when. It was probably late spring, sometime in the summer, I transferred to Grand Canyon. And the way that worked out was that there was I was a GS-5, and there was a bottleneck of GS-7 positions in the Park Service, and it was hard to get that next step.
Bottleneck meaning there were a lot of GS-7s? Or what was the restriction?
I think there were not that many positions that were classified as GS-7. So maybe for every 20 GS-5 positions that there were out in the Park Service, there was maybe one GS-7. I don't know if that ratio is close, but it's just that there was a lot fewer of them.
Okay.
And so most of the general rangers at that time were GS-5s. And then when you start being a 7, you might be a little bit of a, I don't know, an extra good general ranger. And by the time you were a 9, you were supervising stuff.
Okay.
That was then. They changed the whole, there was a program called Ranger Careers in the 90s where they bumped us all up like a level. But anyway, the Park Service did not have many GS-7 jobs. And I ended up wishing to get that, but I didn't. And what I ended up doing was there was a fellow named Dave Stimson that was working at Phantom. And for some reason, I don't know how I came across him, but I came across him maybe at some training session. I don't know what. And he and I started talking, and we both were talking about, yeah, I'm ready to do something different. I got a great job, best job in the Park Service, but I need to get a change and get a little bit more experience so that I'm more marketable in the future for other jobs, like a GS-7 somewhere. But maybe we had been applying, I'm not sure, and not getting jobs. And so between the two, we cooked up this idea to see if we could do a job swap.
How do you spell Dave's last name?
I think it's Stimson. M as in Mary.
Stimson. Okay.
Yeah.
So you guys cooked up this idea to job swap.
Right. So I asked my boss in Canyonlands, Jim Braggs. I said, hey, I'm thinking about, this guy wants to swap jobs with me. What do you think? And he's like, oh, yeah, sounds okay. And apparently Mark Law, who was supervising Phantom at the time, said, sure, go for it. And later I talked to Mark, and he said, we never thought that was really going to happen. We just thought, yeah, go ahead. You know, it's going to get shut down in personnel or something like that. So I don't think either Park really thought that this was going to happen. But Dave and I went to personnel, and we started, you know, going through whatever paperwork steps and seeing if we could do a swap, and we got the swap done, and our superintendent signed off on it, and he took my job in Canyonlands, and I took his job at Phantom. And
wow.
Suddenly, I had a new job, and I was thrilled to be at Phantom because I always kind of preferred the backcountry, and I was along the river. I wasn't on the river crew, but I was seeing river stuff going by, and so it was new. I was always interested in new places and exploring types of,
And this is in the summer of 1986?
Well, it was 1986. I don't remember if it was in the summer or exactly when. It was after I had come back to Canyonlands from Joshua Tree. So it would have been sometime somewhere between May and November, I think. But I can't remember which month it was.
It's hot in Phantom Ranch in the summer. You'd have remembered that.
I do remember being hot down there sometimes, but I can't remember if that was my first initial experience or... I don't remember, like, my first days there. I have no memory of them.
Did you do with Chaz?
Well, I got given this house, or I was assigned to a house that was out on Yaki Point.
Okay.
Next to where the concessioner had some mule barns out there.
Yeah, right at the South Kaibab Trailhead.
Right.
Wow.
And right near it, there was a little house that did not have a good septic system.
Okay.
And so they did not want to put a family into it. It had two bedrooms. It was like an older, small place. And so Mary Liz Gale, I think, was the housing officer at the time. And I feel so sorry for these housing officers because they're always trying to stretch 90 houses to go for 100 people. They just never had enough. And so she thought, okay, here's a permanent employee coming in that's going to need housing, and I'm going to give her this house that that is good if people don't use it very much because of the septic system. And so she'll be down at Phantom most of the time, and that'll be her house on the rim. So I was assigned to that house as my official residence, and I got a roommate. So a woman that I knew from Canyonlands was working seasonal sea collection on the South Rim. And I said, Liz, hey, do you want to get out of seasonal housing and live at my house and take care of my dog for me when I'm down at Phantom?
Oh, well.
And she loved the idea of getting out of seasonal housing. And essentially, she had a house to herself most of the time, which for a seasonal employee was really good because I think they were cramming three of them or more into little trailers and stuff like that. It just was not good housing there. So she moved into the house with me, which sort of defeated the whole purpose of assigning me that house when it was going to be empty.
But you didn't know that. And neither did Mary.
Right. So so Liz was there, and she took care of my dog for me, 10 days. Let's see. No, we worked 9 days. 9 days on. So I would hike down to Phantom on my first day of work. I'd leave my house and my day would start at that moment. I started walking down the trail. And then I would, there were cabins down there that were not assigned to any one person. They were for whoever was working down there. So I got basically assigned to a place called the Rock House, which is where I went to every time I went down. But it could be that someone else was living in there when I was not there. So that's why they gave me official house up on the rim. The Phantom house was just a bunkhouse in a way, but I was the only one in there.
Like a duty station, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, a duty station, right. That's probably the correct lingo. So I had the Rock House. Mark Law would stay in the River Ranger house right next door when he came down. But he and I were opposite shifts, I think. And then there was the Phantom Ranger Station house, I guess, which was kind of a three-bedroom house type thing. And so there was a couple of seasonals that lived in there. And then there was the bunkhouse down at Phantom that the trail crew would stay in when they would come down and stay in the area.
So Mark Law, last name spelled L-A-W, so Mark was the head Phantom Ranger at the time, is that right?
Yes, I think he would have been the Phantom Sub-District Ranger, probably was his title. I think a guy named Butch, that wasn't Butch Farabee, it was Butch, somebody else, was the district ranger, I think, in charge of perhaps what they would call the corridor, which would have been Desert...
Indian Gardens and Cottonwood.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Right. And so that was the corridor, and then the backcountry rangers. I think that was all under a backcountry office.
Okay.
I forgot this other Butch's last name, but he was the district ranger. I think that Mark was a sub-district ranger for, maybe for the corridor. Maybe he was a sub-district ranger of the whole corridor. I bet he was, which meant he might have been overseeing Indian Gardens, Cottonwood, and Phantom.
Okay.
And so he wasn't down at Phantom much at all when I was there. He was, if he went down, I think he went on an opposite shift because I was a permanent employee. So I was, I think, kind of the person that was the permanent employee that was usually around Phantom. And then there were seasonal rangers there.
Okay.
And then I think Mark might have kind of hovered over all of that corridor, and I think that's how it was. I don't remember exactly.
What do you tell me some Mark Law stories? What do you remember of Mark?
Oh boy, there was the whole crew down there, Dave Stimson, Patty Thompson, the Phantom Concessions employees, they had all been around for a while. And when I got there, it took me a while to settle in to that job and to kind of pick up on the things to be doing. And Mark Law gave me a long narrative about how he was disappointed in my performance. And I had never had anybody do that before. But what I can recall is that in Canyonlands, I was pretty much left to my own devices, and I kind of invented my own projects because nobody was giving me very specific or direct assignments. And so Mark operated on a different caliber, and he did say, okay, we want you to repaint a sign. I remember refinishing the signs down there, and we would do patrols early in the morning to see if people were illegally camping, and do patrols through the campground, talk to people to make sure they had their food stored safely, and we would catch excessive numbers of squirrels and relocate them. And so there was very specific tasks that were going on at Phantom, and I thought that I was doing them, but Mark thought that I wasn't doing them to the degree he wanted me to, and so he gave me a long narrative, and I can remember just kind of being caught off guard because I was like, wow, I'm not used to having someone disappointed in my work. And I remember writing a big, long email back to him saying, well, on point one, here's my counter, blah, 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 blah. On point two, blah, 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 blah. I don't remember anything really coming out of it other than that. I don't think it went any further. And we were fine. We didn't, have hostility or bad feelings between us or anything like that. And I'm trying to sum up what my impression of Mark was. I got along with Mark fine, I think eventually after we had a little rough spell there, and I went to his wedding. But he was a little bit, was a little particular about things, maybe is a way to say it. I really don't know that I can sum him up very well, but, I guess that's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the Phantom Ranch crew, I'm wondering if Keith Green and Nancy Green might have been working there then.
I don't recognize those names.
Who do you recognize? Who do you remember was working at?
I remember Patty Thompson. She was a super, super seasonal, and she'd been around for a while. And she, by comparison, I paled in her wake. She was on things, was a super, you know, knew what was going on, and was, she was an ace down there. I don't remember if there was another seasonal ranger. I think there might have been, but eventually there was a fellow that came down. I can't recall his name. There was a woman who was a seasonal maintenance worker. So they had a, so there was a permanent fellow named Vern who ran the sewage treatment plant down there.
Okay.
And he, I forgot Vern's last name. And then on his days off, there was a woman named, I just had her name, Vicki Kellerman. She was his backup or his relief when he had days off, and she would make sure the sewage treatment plant was running properly. So there was actually quite a number of women that were working in that corridor.
Yeah.
Yvette Ruan was working at Indian Gardens.
How do you spell Yvette's last name?
R-U-A-N.
Okay.
And there, in the backcountry office, there were a couple of women. When I think of their names, Jane Hendrick was up there. Bev Perry eventually supervised that. And I forgot her first name, last name, Cheryl. Bev?
Oh, wait. Dave Cheryl and
his wife. She was in the backcountry office. So, anyway, women were becoming not uncommon in the ranger ranks down in the canyon, at least. And I don't remember very many. I don't think I remember any other names down at Phantom.
Okay.
I don't remember I got to know the concessions people in a limited fashion, but I can't remember any of their names.
Okay.
I guess that's about it.
Patty Thompson, did she have red hair?
No, she had blonde hair, and it was real long.
Okay.
Yeah.
What else do you remember about Patty?
We had medical stuff going on down at Phantom. That was part of some of the stuff that we did more of was medical stuff than some of the other things, because people would come down and have problems and hope that they could get a mule ride out, because they had blisters, lots of blisters and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Patty was really good with the medical stuff, as I recall. I don't remember. I don't remember much more. I mean, I have a very distinct image in my mind, but I don't know how to put into words anything more about my memory other than she was. I remember her laughing. And just kind of being a great asset to the Phantom crew. And then I think she kind of went away, and I don't know what happened to her.
Hmm.
I think it was like, what happened to Patty Thompson? After a year or two, she just wasn't around, and I think people didn't quite know what happened to her. And I'm not sure, I don't know what happened to her, so. Oh, and there was a Marie Tuxhorn, I forgot. She was up at Indian Gardens doing maintenance there, I think. So,
how do you spell her name?
Tuxhorn. And she later became a BLM ranger.
What's her first name?
Ranger. Marie.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. She was doing maintenance at Gardens.
Yeah.
Okay. There was a water pipeline guy named Jerry Chavez. Do you remember him?
Nope, don't remember him.
Right. No. Do you remember who else would have been around?
I was there 86 and I left in 88. I wasn't there a great long time.
Okay. Richard Marks would have been the superintendent?
That's right, yeah. I don't even know who the chief ranger was. Off the top of my head.
Yeah,
I'm sure I knew at the time, but escapes me now.
Okay.
So at Phantom, the work to a certain degree was to interface with the people that were passing through there. There were people who were camping there. There were people who were staying at the concessions cabins that either hiked down and stayed there or rode mules down and stayed there. There were some rim to rims, but I don't think anything like what's going on these days.
Right.
And there were a fair number of people who were ill-equipped and ill-prepared and thought they were going to hike to the river for the day and then hike out, you know, that day. And this is before Grand Canyon started their PSAR program or their preventative SAR, preventative search and rescue.
Yeah.
And now they've got great big signs on, like, on the South Kaibab trailhead about trying to advise people that they need to be, we're trying to advise them about what the hike is like, that it's more than they might think it is, and that they need to take water. That signage wasn't there before, and we seems like we'd get people who would be able to kind of see the, I don't know where they saw the river from, or maybe they just imagined it down there, but they decided they'd hike to the river and back in a day, and they would, you know, a lot of times practically never make it, or maybe they didn't make it. They'd get to Phantom, and they'd say, oh, there's no way I can go back, and I'd say, you know, I'm sorry, you have to. We don't have accommodations here for people. You can't just camp here. I don't have a helicopter to take you out. You know, there's just not much choice. You got to keep walking. And I'd shoo them up to Indian Gardens, and they'd become Yvette's problem. occasionally, there would be someone who just absolutely could not walk. And we did have some emergency food that campers would leave behind. And we had some sleeping bags, and we would let them sleep overnight in some of our gear if we felt like it was pretty legitimate. But then they'd have to hike out the next morning, or we'd say we can get you a mule for $420 or whatever the price was.
Right.
Those are your choices. No, there's not a helicopter to take you out of here.
Right.
And so a lot of it was just kind of shooing people on, or the trouble was shooing people on. 95% of the people down there were fine because they were backpacking down and had a campsite or had arrangements and had not made the mistake of thinking that they could hike to the river and back
in a day. Right.
But the problems were the people that thought they could and then got down there and figured out that they couldn't. And then we had to figure out, well, now what? There were some medicals. One time I remember thinking I was so brilliant with this resolution. There was a woman and her husband that hiked down into the Grand Canyon for their anniversary every year for the last 40 years or something like that. And so they were getting to be older. And I'm going to guess they were in their 70s.
Oh, wow.
In the 80s. They were hiking down, and and they had younger family members with them, either their children or grandchildren. But she got down towards the tip-off, and her legs started giving out, and she could not hold herself up. You know, she just would collapse. And so we got the call that there was somebody needing assistance up there. And I'm like, okay. So I grabbed a wheelbarrow, and I trundled it across the bridge to the bottom of the trail there below tip-off, and I started hiking up with the idea that I would just, you know, give her my shoulder to put her arm around and help her down, and then once I got her there, I'd put her in the wheelbarrow. Well, her family had gotten her down by that kind of means of supporting her and helping her walk down, and she was pretty close to it, and I did. She was a small woman. I just had her sit in the wheelbarrow, and I wheeled her the rest of the way in, and I'd like to call it my Phantom ambulance. She had reservations at the Phantom.
Oh, at the lodge.
Yeah, so she stayed there a few days, and I don't remember after that. I think she got her strength back and hiked out at the end, but that was one medical I remember. There was another fellow that had a pneumothorax down there, and the weather was really bad. So we had a little bed in the Phantom Ranger station, and there was a kind of a mini clinic, kind of a small room that had been turned into a clinic, and he was certain he had a pneumothorax because he had one before. And he said, I know what this is. So I took his vitals. I was the person that that handled him or treated him or met with him. And I did the whole EMT kind of thing and assessed him. And but we had medical control up on the rim. Do you remember Sherry?
Collins?
Collins, yeah. So she was in charge of EMS in the canyon at the time.
Okay.
So before, it was her call when we started evacuating people. So I relayed all my information up to her and said, I've got this patient here that believes that he's having a pneumothorax. He's had it before. Here's his vitals. You know, I might get him helicoptered out of here. And she was kind of hesitant about it. And she said, well, let's just give him a day and see how he feels. Because the Park Service was not, the Park Service was very conservative with use of the helicopter.
Right.
And
so I'm just, pneumothorax, I'm thinking of a collapsed lung. And when that happens, it the people who've had it before, they know it. And they know that it's a medical emergency. It's hard for them to get it across to others that they're losing their respiratory function, their ability to breathe.
Right.
So and I can appreciate Sherry's like, oh, yeah, yeah. We get these people all the time that say that's happening.
Right.
But if, you know, it's hard for the person who's having it because they look okay. You know, they're not like gray or ashen and their vitals.
You know, I believed him. I believed him, but I think I was not a proven entity to Sherry yet, necessarily.
Oh, okay.
And she didn't know whether I was overreacting. She didn't know whether this patient was overreacting.
Yeah. Or lying, also, just hoping to get a flight out.
Right.
Yeah.
There was also weather complications that came up, because I remember at some point she had, well, you know, in my memory, she did not just jump on, oh, yeah, we'll get him out right away.
Okay.
She gave it a little time, and it might have been only a few hours, but there was a little bit of a, like, okay, let's wait and see on her part.
Okay.
But meanwhile, there became terrible weather, and the helicopter couldn't fly in. So, as I remember, the poor guy had to spend the night down there before the helicopter could get down. You know, the weather played a role, and so this went longer than he was certainly comfortable with. And I was starting to be like, I don't know about this.
Yeah.
He did get flown out eventually. He did have a pneumothorax, you know, and so it all got resolved fine. But I remember, you know, that was one of my bigger my bigger medical cases.
What else do you remember about Sherry?
I felt that she was very professional and very on the ball and sharp and knew her business and was not someone that was going to be, I mean, she knew what she was doing, and she didn't mind making hard calls.
Uh-huh.
I had a great respect for her.
Nice.
Yeah. And so we had medical stuff at Phantom. We had, I mean, stuff that wasn't really seriously medical. It was inconvenient or slightly painful, but people needed to keep moving because we weren't getting them a helicopter for blisters. We did some evacuations, and actually I wrenched my back one time because we were carrying a litter. I don't remember what I don't know if it was this guy that I just told you about or somebody else for some reason we were evacuating out, but I do remember a litter with four of us carrying it to the heliport, and the trail was very narrow with kind of rocks lining it.
Yeah.
And I had to twist, my footing was not, I didn't have a path to walk on. I was kind of working around rocks. And somehow in the course of that, I ended up with an injured back. And so I ended up on light duty for a couple weeks. And I got reassigned up to the backcountry office. So I kept working, but I was they swapped me out, basically. Somebody else came down to Phantom for a while so they could do foot patrols and all the stuff they should be doing. And I worked at the backcountry office so that I could go do some PT and be on light duty. Yeah. Maybe it was 4 weeks. I can't remember how long.
Did you get evaluated at the clinic?
I did.
Do you remember who the doctor was who visited?
Well, I think there was a... Was there a Nancy Elder or somebody, either with a Nancy or an Elder? It was a female doctor.
Okay.
I believe. That would have been there in 86. She also removed some moles from my back.
Okay. Cheryl Pagel, I remember her, but
no.
She might have been gone by then. And Tom Myers and Jim Wergler. Well, Tom hadn't started yet, but Jim might have been there.
Yeah, I don't remember those names.
Okay.
And it was definitely a woman.
Okay.
Yeah. And she was around for a little bit because I did have at least two encounters with her.
Okay.
So, what else about Phantom? Didn't do too much with the river people. They kind of came in and did their business and then just moved on.
Right. They would do exchanges. People would hike in and hike out from river trips.
Right.
And river people would eventually, occasionally, bring you someone who was hurt that they'd gotten down to Phantom.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, could have. I mean, that would definitely have been something that's happened in the past. I don't remember specifically that, so either I didn't deal with it or else I just forgot it.
Uh-huh.
Didn't have a lot of law enforcement down there, although there was one time where there was somebody down at, if you're going from Indian Gardens and hiking to Phantom, where you first hit the river.
Pipe Creek.
Pipe Creek, yeah. At Pipe Creek, there was somebody that was illegally camping there, I think, and then another ranger and I. And for some reason, anyways, we went in and told him to move, and I have a sense that we thought he might be dangerous somehow, and I don't have any idea where that notion came from. I don't remember that it turned into anything. We just told him he had to go, but there was some sense of, I think two of us should go, maybe this guy's got, I don't know what the cause of the hesitancy with just walking up to him was, but we were on our guard when we went into his camp and talked to him. But really, there was something else where I had to, there was a few law enforcement things, but just not much. I remember there was a guy that was pretty certain that the CIA had put a chip in his brain and he was being monitored from space all the time. So he was a little, nuts. And I guess he just hiked himself out. I can't remember what happened to him. He was harmless, but he was not, he was off his meds is what he was.
Yeah.
So really not a lot of serious law enforcement down there. Something else that I can remember another incident, but I don't even remember enough of it to describe what happened. So I think we had illegal campers that we would come across that hadn't gotten reservations for the campground, and we would just give them a citation, and they'd have to pay it, and we told them that they'd need to move on. And so I'd go down on my first day of work. I'd stay down there on my ninth day. I would hike out 9-hour days, except for the last one was an 8-hour day, something like that. And then I'd have 5 days off. I did not do very much backpacking in the Grand Canyon when I worked there because when I had my days off, I didn't want to turn around and go back in.
Right.
So I wanted to go get groceries and go to a movie and be on the rim for a while and go skiing in the winter up there and whatever. So since I've retired, I've done a lot more backpacking in the Grand Canyon than I ever did when I worked there because now it's a treat to go there and backpack on my off time, which is always. But at the time, I just didn't want to turn around and go back in. I did go to, did a backpack off the North Rim one time, I remember, down into, oh gosh, I can't remember all these, where you could hike down to Surprise Valley. And
oh, yeah,
Deer
Thunder River and Deer Creek.
Yeah, Thunder River, I did that one.
Okay.
But most of my time when I was not working was either on the rim or out of there, going to Flagstaff or going some, I don't know, somewhere else.
Did you, go down to Sedona or head off to Lake Powell at all or Bryce?
I know I went down to the desert I don't know when, in the summer. I remember being in Yuma.
Oregon Pipe, maybe?
And probably Oregon Pipe, yeah. I don't know that I would have gone to Powell much. That
mm-hmm.
didn't draw my attention. And I'm sure I went through Sedona because I would have just been curious about it. But that was, the biking wasn't there then.
Right.
And I just probably looked around at the beautiful scenery and
mm-hmm.
and then went somewhere else.
It's funny you mentioned the few rim-to-rim people, and I thought, yeah, they all had kids that became rim-to-rimmers, and now the place is overrun.
Right.
It was like
30 yeah.
years ago when, 35 years ago or so, another generation back.
Right, that's true, yeah.
So it's kind of funny to sort of ponder that.
Yeah.
Back when there wasn't half as many people as there is now.
Right. Yeah, that just started flooring me when I heard of all those rim-to-rims, because it was a hard enough hike just to go in and out of Fenton. Well, anyway.
Right, yeah.
I just was always just like, you've got to be kidding me.
And the rim-to-rim-to-rim people, so.
I know.
Yeah.
Even worse.
Huh.
Oh, another few things that I did was I did get on a couple river trips when I was assigned at Phantom. The park was really good about trying to cross-train people a little bit and get them exposed to places other than just where they were working. So one time I hiked down Nankoweap and joined the river crew. It was a trails trip in November to do rehab trails at Nankoweap and somewhere else, where they were trying to eliminate social trailing and by putting cactus in the trails and other means of deterring people from wandering aimlessly through there.
Hey, Pat.
Yeah?
I'm wondering, we've been going on for about an hour here.
Okay.
I got a lot of questions for you about the Grand Canyon River trips versus Canyonlands River trips and
yeah.
who was on the trips and what do you remember about them and,
sure.
and all that. Maybe it's a good time to
call it quits.
Wrap up part four, but you know where we'll be going for part five.
Yes.
Okay.
Great.
That sounds good. Okay. Well, with that, then, this will conclude part four, oral history interview with Pat Gredigan. And today is Monday, November 23rd, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Pat, thank you so much for this.
Yes, you're always welcome.